You are listening to the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Greetings and salutations, my good people. Welcome once again to the show. I'm your host, Marty Leeds. A few notes before we get started. I was recently a guest on the Freeman Fly Show, and you can get that at freemantv.com. We spoke for about an hour, and it was a good show. Freeman and Jamie are cool cats over there, so go and check that out. He's got a lot of information on that channel, and he also posted all of the Free Your Mind conference speeches on that channel, so you can go to his site and check all that out through his site. I also just uploaded a few new videos to my channel on YouTube. I just posted my speech from the SyncBook Summit. It's about an hour or so speech, and I would highly recommend everyone check it out. I was really proud of that speech, and I thought Alan Abadesa Green, who is one of the hosts and organizers of the conference, did a stellar job with the editing of it. It's basically a mini movie on gematria and the sacred geometry of the human hands, and I think everyone will enjoy it. So please go check that out. I also just wrote and posted a new song called I Won't Be Coming Home to You Tonight on my channel. So if you like quiet, folky little ditties about heartache and longing, well, this is the song for you. So I also want to say congratulations to my friends Ryan and Heather Reese on the birth of their daughter Juniper Rose Marie. She was born free just about 2 weeks ago now. So congratulations, guys. Much love and happiness to you in the future. I also want to say, if you do like this podcast, please go to iTunes and post a review for me. It just helps people get a sense of the quality material that is covered on the show, and it helps me get the word out. So please do that if you get a chance. Alrighty, that is it for the announcements tonight. Our guest tonight is author of The State is Out of Date, Gregory Sams, and the musical guest is the Southern Wisconsin blues band, The Jimmies. This show is brought to you by The SyncBook Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Middle Chamber, and Synchronize. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support. Our guest tonight is Gregory Sams. From 1967, Gregory Sams was pioneering natural foods in the UK in partnership with his brother Craig. He opened Seed Macrobiotic Restaurant at the age of 19, Ceres Grain Store soon after, then Harmony Foods, which is now Whole Earth Foods, in 1970. He conceived and launched the original veggie burger in 1982, adding a word to the language as he opened up the market for vegetarian foods. In 1990, Greg moved out of food and into fractals, founding Strange Attractions, the world's only shop ever dedicated to chaos theory. Gregory went on to produce and license fractal images worldwide and everything from posters to book covers to fashion fabrics. His interest in chaos theory, however, was not just for the images, but for the social lessons inherent in the discovery of self-organizing systems throughout the world. This led him to write and publish in 1998 his first book, Uncommon Sense: The State is Out of Date. It was well received, and enjoying his role as an author, Gregory spent the first 7 years of the next millennium writing Son of God, that's S-U-N of God, in which, as he puts it, the biggest elephant in the room that you could ever imagine is unveiled. Tonight we're going to be speaking about the updated version of The State is Out of Date, which you can get at www.gregorysams.com as well as on amazon.com. You can actually get both of his books there. So without further ado, let's get pious with Gregory Sams. Gregory, welcome to the show. Thanks so kindly. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I've been really looking forward to this.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marty. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So I just finished your book last night, actually, and I loved it. It's fresh in my mind, so this is going to be a lot of fun. So
fantastic.
Yeah. So The State is Out of Date. This is an updated version from the original one you wrote in 1998. Is that correct?
1998. I know. Way too far ahead of its time.
Yeah. So it's really well put together. I mean, I really like. It felt like reading it. It felt like. This was a re-examination of these original ideas, and it was important to re-examine these because it seemed like they were more prevalent than ever.
Yeah. Wait, how do you mean more prevalent where?
Just kind of in every facet. It seems like everything that you brought up, I didn't read the original one, of course, but it seemed right, yeah. like you just by reading it, I could tell that you were bringing up things and then bringing these ideas back up because it seemed like the original concepts were more prevalent than ever in our modern times, 16 years later.
Well, the mask has dropped from the coercive state. It's far more sort of stripped away by social media than it ever was in 1998, which was virtually before internet for most people. Mm-hmm. So it's, people are more aware that Big Brother doesn't always have our best interest in mind.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm just rubbing that point in and showing why Big Brother, whether it's the Pope or the Pharaoh or the President or the Premier, is never going to have our best interest in mind, because the structure makes that impossible. The structure of the state, this coercive top-down, do this or we will damage you, modus operandi.
Mm-hmm. So where was Gregory Sams at age 19? I mean, I do a little bio before the show, and I kind of talk about you pioneering businesses with the organic food industry. Mm-hmm. Where were you then? Like, what was your state of mind then? And as towards statism, ideologies and things like that. And then it's going through these successes and seeing history ensue as it has. Where are you now? Are you more optimistic? Do you see things moving in the right direction, or that sort of thing?
Well, lots of things are moving in the right direction. I mean, when I was 19, I was sort of fully fledged hippie at the time, but opening and running a macrobiotic restaurant, which was packed out every night, introducing people to natural organic foods, but also very cognizant of the fact that the state wasn't working, and all through those natural food and introducing the veggie burger and various different things, the status quo was always leaning on you, trying to drill holes in what you're doing, because the status quo doesn't like new things. But what has changed enormously since then is that so many people have come round to, if you want to put it, our way of thinking, because they're the whole 67, back to the earth, honor the earth, don't rape it, but take its benefits. That whole ethos was squashed in the 60s and it just slowly began to reemerge in the 90s. And now, so many people know about, I know it sounds stupid, but know what yoga is, mm-hmm. and know what meditation is. People didn't used to know what that stuff was. Looking within, what do you mean look within? There's nothing in there but my intestines. We've come a hell of a long way since then, and part of that is being more connected. We're so much more connected than we were when some people had landline telephones, but most people had to communicate by post. Mm-hmm. Now information, new ideas, hey, this changed my life, why don't you try it out? That's spreading so fast now that it's really encouraging to me, and I believe, hopefully not in vainly, that there might be some quantum shift in consciousness, that enough people get switched on that we actually manage to disengage ourselves from the coercive state that increasingly seems irrelevant on the world scene. All they do is fight and try and figure out ways to expend more weapons.
Yeah, so, where do you feel that humanity needs to put its most focus on right now? Obviously, your book is talking about getting rid of the state, but, beyond that, it seems education is the most important thing. In fact, educating people about the coerciveness of the state seems to be pretty imperative, right?
Well, the state runs the education system, yeah. Certainly in this country, in the U.S. So, yeah, education and education offline or off the national grid, if you like, and you would get a lot of that through YouTube, Twitter, Facebook. I mean, there's all kind of information sharing and ideas going on there. I think the headset change we need is for people to take responsibility for themselves, if only because the state isn't doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not looking after, whether it's protecting our children from pedophilia, pedophiles, or giving us a good education, or creating peace and harmony in the land. They're not doing it. So all those people who think, well, we've got to have somebody telling us what to do or it would be mayhem, you know, that's we have got people telling us to do what to do, and it is mayhem. And it's something we're much better at doing ourselves, and we do it on a massive scale online, where you get all these online businesses have set up, and they manage the morality and the efficiency of their businesses. So when you get people doing bad online, they tend to get shunted out because people recognize this guy screwed me, or this customer didn't pay for the goods that he said he was going to. And that goes up as feedback. And other people see that feedback and they say, hey, I don't want to deal with that person. And slowly, sometimes quickly, the bad eggs get pushed out of the system and the good eggs rise to the top. At the moment, we, you know, in the sort of prior paradigm, we often have, you know, particularly if you look at mass catering and all the restaurants that open up, fast food outlets, we have scum rising to the top and the cream gets sidelined. You have to hunt it out in some back alley somewhere.
Yeah, it seems like when things happen, like online, people do these things themselves. There's a morality, there's an integrity to it. There's a, you know, it's like this natural form of creativity when this gets put in the people's hands, this is what tends to happen. But when we put it in the state's hands, this is where the corruption ensues, right?
Absolutely, because they don't care. I mean, you've got equivalents in America, but you've got the massive farm subsidies there. We've got the Common Agricultural Board here, which regulates agriculture throughout the common market, which is the largest area of, you know, people in the world. And we know, and it always has been, that a third of their budget expenditure is fraudulent. Mm-hmm. People claiming for stuff that they haven't done. And of course, why should they care? The bureaucrats running that, their job is to give out the money, to tick the boxes, make sure all the forms are filled in and shuffled about. If somebody's pulling out, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions over the years out of that system, it's no skin off their nose. Where, you know, it's not going to affect their jobs, it's just more customers. Whereas if you've got, you know, you can pick the biggest, nastiest supermarket chain you like, and if they find somebody adulterating the bread they're supplying with sawdust, or they find some employee who's, you know, ripping off stocks, they push that out of the system. You know, you just don't put up with that stuff. Yeah. But the you know, governments are riddled with it. Occasionally we get dramas on TV, like House of Cards, that illustrate this perfectly for us, and it's entertaining and it's surprising, but it's going on nonstop in the halls of power.
Mm-hmm. So what's your response to somebody that says, oh, how are we, you know, what's going to happen if we get rid of the state? It's going to be chaos. It's going to be anarchy. This is just some hippie ideological nonsense. You know, what is your response to that?
My response is, look at what we've got right now. You've got 50 or 60% of the wealth we produce is sucked out of society into the state. Less than an eighth of that comes back in housing benefits, unemployment, pay, and that sort of stuff. And we've got mindless wars where some of our guys are getting killed and 100,000 plus of innocent people going about their business are getting slaughtered, bombed, killed in the Middle East. It is chaos. It is mayhem. And we've got a history of working things out on our own in an equitable manner on a large scale. There was an Indus Valley civilization which went from at least 7,500 BC to 1600 BCE. This was a highly developed civilization with underground plumbing, waste disposal. This was like 2,500 BC, right? Every house in the Indus Valley cities had its own fresh water supply, had a wastewater outlet. They had roads, they had commerce and trade, they had granaries and dockyards where ships would go to and from. 2,600 BCE, I keep repeating this date because, you know, we think everybody was primitive then, you know, killing each other. They had a high civilization with, did I mention, standardized weights and measures throughout it. There was no sign of a nobility, a hierarchy, you know, some people in palaces and some in slums. There was no indication anywhere of conflict, warfare, soldiers, defensive ramparts. They lived really peacefully. And they developed a high level of civilization. You had the same thing going on in the Fertile Crescent in Mesopotamia for 4,000 years before the first wars and conquest type of stuff broke out. You even had medieval cities in Europe that were self-run, bottom-up run corporations. Florence was one of those. Florence was a private entity. They weren't owned by some duke or king. They had a wall around themselves to protect them from thugs on horseback who came and said, hey, my duke needs some money to, you know, maintain his spurious lifestyle. And that was the engine of the Renaissance, Florence. They had, at one point, they had a population of 90,000 and they had 800 kids in school, 8,000 kids in school, sorry, 600 in higher education. They had civilization without that top-down control, because we do self-manage. It's we're built as community animals, and we have societies, we have groups, we have, you know, companies all used to belong to guilds. So if you're a baker or an architect or a jeweler, you know, but if you're a baker, you belong to the Baker's Guild. And if you started making bad bread that was, you know, shortchanging people, or heaven forbid, poisoning them, well, you know, you would be giving the whole baker's industry a bad name, and you'd get thrown out of the guild. Same if you were diluting the gold in your jewelry or building houses that fell down. That's self-regulation. You have it now with Airbnb. You know, they don't have government inspectors coming in, checking the kitchens of everybody who's making breakfast, making sure that the beds don't have bed bugs in them, making sure the toilets are hygienic. You know, we're really good at self-managing stuff like that. And if heaven forbid, somebody slips through the net, they have $1 million insurance cover for anybody who's providing a roof for travelers. If your house burns down or something horrible happens as a result of that, they've got $1 million insurance cover, and I bet they hardly ever have to use it. But that's self-regulation, and we are good at it when we're given the chance. We have all sorts of standards, well, not enough, but we have organic food standards, we have fair trade standards, we have ways of doing this that don't involve the sort of government inspectors, courts, police, smashed doors, and prisons. I mean, how crazy is it that somebody who is screwing us gets arrested, taken to court, put into prison, and then we have to pay? I don't know what it is in America, but in England, it's equivalent of $50,000 to $60,000 a year to keep somebody in prison. So we're getting screwed twice by that guy.
Actually, my friend owns a Airbnb or runs that, and he does really well with it. He just started a couple of years ago, and yeah, he's just gotten great response online. And this self this self-regulation, self-organization that we see, it's that comes from, it's this bottom-up approach. This is something that, to me, it almost seems like, well, in order to call ourselves a civilization, we have to be civilized, and this is a civil approach to social organization. You know, let's talk about chaos theory, because I know this is one of the things that brought you to this sort of ideology. I know this has been close to your heart for a long time now. What is chaos theory, and how does this apply to social self-organization?
Well, chaos theory was kind of recognized in the sort of 1979 was the first kind of hint of it, and it's the recognition of complex systems self-organizing into some sort of a harmonious, balanced structure. Now, a complex system is something that's got more parts to it than you can count, and each part is acting independently and unpredictably. So, classic, easy example is a rainforest where you've got all your frogs and your trees and your other animals and the fish and the rivers, and you've got clouds and you've got winds and you've got rain, and they're all acting independently, but they all form into this balanced structure where things are feeding into each other and things are working. A more etheric example is a weather system, where you've got, you know, countless quadrillions of water molecules, and they're in a system with heat, with humidity, with wind, with clouds passing over the sun, and with, you know, a jogger panting in the park and butterflies flapping their wings. And all of this tends to create weather systems, fluffy little clouds, jet streams, currents in the ocean. You know, you get systems that organize and develop out of that, and you've got different types of clouds that can develop, and that's stuff self-organizing. It's equally as difficult to comprehend as how all those water molecules self-organize is when we feed cities the size of London or New York, where there are millions of people. You can't predict what each one of them is going to want to eat, when they're going to be hungry, and how much money they've got in their pocket. And even if you could, the computer system that was going to feed these people would be a joke. But we do it really well without any top-down control. We self-organize into that. And when I recognized this, I already had understandings under my belt about the value of freedom, a free enterprise. I'd already taken a long, difficult course by somebody named Professor Andrew J. Galambos, who had he was teaching volitional science, you know, the science of you know, what happens when things are voluntarily done. So I had quite ingrained on the relevance of all of this. I'd also studied Lao Tzu when I was a teenager, who is sometimes referred to as the world's first anarchist. But so I had I had my own experience running businesses for about 20 years. And so when I discovered chaos theory, I said, well, here's some scientific backup to these wild ideas that, not to me, but ideas other people think are wild. And at the same point, I realized that scientists were very unlikely to apply chaos theory to society, social operations, because social science is a dirty word to most pure scientists. You don't go there. You get your fingers burned. You know, you can't, you know, it's a very difficult area for scientists to get involved in. And I thought, well, hell, this is the most important part of this science, is how it applies to humanity.
Yeah, you say in the book, it says, I have a quote here, social science is a dirty word to most pure scientists, as you just said, and it's not surprising when you consider some of the appalling things that have been done in its name, and we could go to Stalin, Pol Pot, that sort of thing. But yeah. If we speak of organizing ourselves socially by simply following natural law, like things like the Golden Rule, conservation, frugality, mm-hmm. appreciation of nature, these sorts of things, then the conversation suddenly takes a different turn, because it's not, this is not some, you know, that social engineering is not necessarily totalitarian, if you will. It's also, it can be from nature, from bottom up, as you were saying.
Absolutely, yeah. And you have, I mean, it's a whole mix from, you know, kids selling lemonade on the streets to large corporations shipping iPhones from China to England in container ships built in Korea. That's all, you know, that is social organization. And that's what we are really good at. And there are certain areas that the government has taken over. But for thousands of years, well, not for that many, for the 4,500 years that we had a state in any place, they their main job was to protect us from other states. Mm-hmm. They never got involved in the food we ate or how we were educated or what types of vehicles we used. You know, that was nothing to do with them. Mm-hmm. And it's only in the last 100 or 200 years that they've become involved in our private lives and said, oh, well, the food supply is too important to leave to chaos. So we're going to have to get involved with agriculture. Mm-hmm. And as a result now, both in North America and Europe, all your large farmers lose money and depend on government subsidies to exist, which is crazy. You know, farmers, they've always made money, made a living by providing what people want to eat. And that's a really nice feedback loop that eventually works through from those people eating their lunches in the cities to what farmers grow. Now they grow what they're directed to by the government. And, you know, the American corn crop is completely subsidized. There's so much agriculture is government managed, and you have this horrible, you know, the factory farms, because the government thought we should eat more meat. There's just so much disruption. You don't need the government involved in agriculture or education or even healthcare.
Because people are going to make the best decisions for themselves because they have self-preservation in mind, correct?
They really do. And if I decide to go see some doctor somebody else decides or thinks is a quack, that's my right. Mm-hmm. And if I die as a result, that's my fault. And that's fine. And other people are going to be less likely to go to that quack doctor because I died as a result, you know?
Yeah.
But instead of that, you put everybody that, you know, might be branded a quack doctor in jail because they haven't been through 6 years of medical college or whatever it is. And you give the AMA a monopoly over medicine. And then you have, you know, so you have the whole American health policy is governed more by pharmaceutical companies and the medical industry than by people, how people want to be healed.
Which is just poison to the populace.
It really is. It's such a personal choice how we look after our health, our bodies. And it's just so outrageous that the government is involved under the guise of protecting us. Did the story of the English school kid get into the American press? This kid, an English kid who was 8 years old and had brain cancer. His parents took him out of the, you know, forcibly removed him from hospital and went to Spain to get this new type of proton beam treatment for his brain tumor, which is much more effective than normal radiation therapy. It's not an off-the-wall pray and chant therapy. And he had been given up for dead. You know, the UK medical establishment said, well, he may live a couple of years, but it's a pretty hopeless case. But when his parents took him out, the doctors went to the hospital, went to the police. There was an international manhunt. A few days later, Interpol tracked down this father and mother and their child in Spain. Spanish police went in, arrested the parents, bundled them into a car, put them in jail, and put the kid into hospital as a ward of the state. And it was just unbelievable.
Which is basically the state saying to the children, to the child and the parents, that you do not have a right to your body.
You don't have a right to your body, and, you know, don't challenge authority. You challenge authority, we're going to come down on you. and make you wish you hadn't, just as, you know, you'd be really stupid in America to, you know, wave a knife at the police from a distance and say anything bad to them, because they just shoot you.
Mm-hmm. Kind of going back to this thing of idea of like a chaos theory, that this is basically a mathematical model, if you will, of recognizing that every conscious entity ultimately affects the whole. And in order for that whole to, as you point out in the book, to be a successful and sustainable system, each part, each conscious entity, if you will, has to have interdependence, flexibility, freedom. And this is what creates the ultimate order, if you will, the order from the chaos. This makes a lot of sense to me, because it seems that any restriction from our freedom seems to be a restriction from natural law, meaning, you know, that we are born free. This is just a fact of life. We have no overarching master or law, you know, lawgiver besides natural law.
Yeah.
And so when the state gets in the way, it seems like this is an impedance to that.
It absolutely is.
By its very nature.
I mean, those feedback loops are absolutely what create civilization, culture, and what keeps it constantly adjusting to circumstances and evolving. And once you cut those feedback loops and you go in and say, let's just say you go in and you say, okay, I'm going to ban factory farms. And vegetarians might go in and say, well, we really, you know, the problem with the world is too much meat, you know, methane killing the ozone layer, chewing up all our food, so we're going to ban meat. It doesn't work. That's not the way to achieve that change, because that's breaking the feedback loops that eventually get us where we need to go. And it's just such a vital part. And even though they have broken the feedback loops and are badly managing things, whether it's health, education, or agriculture, if they were out of the picture, it would not take us very long to figure this stuff out and to actually get these things working, and to the point where we would look back and say, my God, can you believe we used to let the government do this? Look what was happening when they did it. And imagine, let's imagine that the state ran the shoe industry and they had a committee that decided what shapes and colors and sizes of shoes we were going to get each year, or what sort of music we're going to listen to. Can you imagine the difference between the selection we have now and what those guys would be deciding on for us? And it's just because they've already taken over, not the shoe industry. Well, when I was in Zimbabwe, the government ran the toilet paper industry. There was only one brand of toilet paper made by the government. And I'm tempted to say it was shit.
I was going to say.
But just because they've been doing it for a few generations, people think, oh, how could we cope without that? And I even apply this to, there's a chapter in the book on it, which is a bit too much to go into in detail over the radio, but even crime and how you deal with criminality. The state has been doing this. Well, police came into being in the mid-19th century only, but the state's been running this, and it's still police, jails, and courts. And the only innovation, well, not innovation really, change, is there's so many more things to go to jail for now than there ever were before. And so many of them are victimless crimes, because there's not that many of the population who go out and stab and shoot and break into houses to fill up the amount of jails they want to fill up. So they make, you know, not filling in government forms properly as a crime, smoking, you know, altering your own state of mind, whether it's with pot or whatever else, is a crime. And more than half of the prisoners in jail are there for victimless crimes. Mm-hmm. And we're having to pay for all their upkeep. So we're suffering as a result of somebody doing something for which there was no victim. And that's the point. There's nothing they do that we can't. I mean, everything they do is actually stuff that we are doing. Because you don't see politicians out laying roads or doing open heart surgery. We do all of that, And the government pays for those things to be done with our money. Mm-hmm. So it's just, all we need to do is figure out how to do stuff that we're already doing in a different way, and in a way which joins those feedback loops back together, and in a way that enables the system to be managed from the bottom of the pyramid up, rather than have this completely disconnected tiny percentage at the top of the pyramid that is supposedly deciding what is in our best interests, and then forcing that through with legislation and punishment if you don't obey.
You know, this is such an excellent point that you're bringing up, because people will say, well, God, what's going to happen? It's going to be anarchy and chaos if we don't, you know, if the state, who's going to build the roads? If we get rid of the state, who's going to take care? Who's going to teach the children? It's like, people forget that we're already doing that. We, the people, are already doing that. All we're doing when we talk about getting the state out of our lives is taking away the middleman, if you will, right?
Absolutely, and it's a really inefficient, ineffective middleman.
Yeah, absolutely ineffective. So, and the power of the state is really interesting. Is something you brought up in the book as well. Is that actually here? You have a quote. It's from Buckminster Fuller, who was yet another brilliant, you know, mathematician, architect, engineer. Yeah. He said the end move in politics is always to pick up a gun. Yeah. And so we have this division between the monster of the state and the people in regards to authority, power, and violence. That really, no one has any sort of authority to commit violence to another by natural law, yet somehow the state has this authority. And so they make criminals out of people, and then they say, you know, oh, well, if you don't follow this, well, we're going to stick that gun in your face, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, theft and murder, or, you know, stealing from people and killing people has always been regarded as criminal activity. And then when you sort of call theft taxation, and you call killing people war, suddenly it's okay. You know, it's normal, okay human behavior.
It's just part of the business of the state, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you have this chapter in the book, I think it's called Who Owns You? And it talks about the state, simply by being born into a particular landmass or whatever, that the state assumes authority over you. And whether you are coerced into this unknowingly, or whether, you know, this is just what they assume. Now, in my opinion, there can be like no document you can sign or paper you can scrawl in blood that makes it legally, naturally, in any sort of way to make another individual someone's property, whether that's from the state or slavery, if you will. So, because ultimately this is a breaking of natural law, and it's really hard to get people to kind of understand this, that just because you were born doesn't necessarily mean that you are property of the state. I mean, this is, to me, it's an absolute fallacy. And how do we get people to shine a light on this, if you will?
It all comes down to taking responsibility for ourselves and not expecting things from the state. It was the first passports came in as a result of, in Russia, had some sort of social security in the 19th century, some sort of benefits paid out to people. And it was for a long time, it was done on a local level. But when they moved it up to a national level, people started to come into the country just to pick up on this stuff. And then they had to start regulating the borders, who came in, who came out, who's authorized to get this. And as long as we are, you know, sucking at the breast of the state and thinking, oh, well, you know, I'm gonna take them for everything I can, or you know, I need this money, we're going to have those measures imposed on us. I think it's outrageous that we have to show bits of paper to cross imaginary lines drawn on a map. Mm-hmm. We're human beings. Why can't we just go where we want? Well, because we might take advantage of the state. So population X is having money, you know, taxes, money taken from them to pay for the state, and a little bit gets sprinkled back here and there. And, you know, population Y, did I start with X or Y? I can't even remember. Population Z, you know, well, they can't come in and get our benefits because they haven't been paying taxes. And, you know, that when we were free people, you could go anywhere you wanted in the world. And you would have to make your own way in that country. You might have friends there or relatives or special skills that could be tapped in You couldn't just go there and expect to have a roof over your head, money in your pocket, and your medical expenses paid for, which is the case in most of Europe, and it's to a degree the case in America. People go there because they know they're going to end up with a much better standard of living, whether they do anything or not. And it's just America was settled by immigrants, illegal immigrants coming in on the Mayflower. That's how society has been for thousands of years, and suddenly we have these passports. They're an abomination. That's what they are, Marty. Abomination.
Yeah, I mean, it's once again, it gets to this point where it's like, seems like the state owns you. It tells you where you can go, what you can do. And the thing that I always want to get back to is maybe like the solutions or resolutions to how to dismantle these fallacies, how to dismantle, yeah, you know, piece by piece from the bottom up, as you say. And like, yeah, what are some solutions? Because I know you're just as concerned about those as I am, because we could talk all day long about the problems. Well, everybody knows the problems, right?
There are a lot of people now becoming sovereign individuals.
Sure.
And there are legal ways to disengage yourself from that contract with the state. And I'm not sure how successful they all are. I'm sure some are. But in principle, you can legally exempt yourself from paying income tax or from being in any way subservient to the state. And I hope that that also entails it being unable to take anything from the state. But you still, you know, you're not going to be able to buy whiskey without paying them their tax, or gasoline without paying them your tax, unless you have your own well in your backyard. And I still don't know how easy it is for a sovereign individual to cross from one nation to another without having the U.S. government's pass. So what I think, how do we get there? I think the opportunity is coming up that we will have, which is in the 2008 global financial crisis, wasn't solved or resolved. It was kicked downstream, mm-hmm, which they've been doing for a while. And the only danger of that crisis was that major financial institutions and banks would collapse. If they had collapsed, some nation states would have collapsed as well, who are kept afloat on the smoke and mirrors of fiat currencies. And I'm saying, my policy is if and when that financial collapse comes back, that we should embrace it and let it happen, because they're not talking about, you know, supermarkets or Apple or anybody like that collapsing. They're talking about these major financial institutions to collapse. And they create this fiat currency system and support the whole system of taxation, which is part of the problem. And if you're looking at tennis balls and apples, at the moment, tennis balls cost 4 or 5 times as much as an apple. That's not because they're priced at $5 instead of $1. It's because they're worth more. And if we had a famine, those tables would be flipped, and we'd have a situation where the apples were worth more than tennis balls. Mm-hmm. But that's got nothing to do with the international financial system. Mm-hmm. That's got to do with tennis balls being worth more. And that's not that hard a thing to figure out in the mechanism of exchange. If you look at all the work and talent and processes that go into making an iPhone, let's say, that's a lot of complexity. A lot has to be done. Now, how you decide that that iPhone is worth 500 tennis balls is a piece of cake, if I might say so. And you don't need, you know, Chase Manhattan and the Rothschilds and the World Bank and the World Trade Association to figure that out. So if all this shit collapses, we will go on. It's a rough road, perhaps, but you know, humanity and commerce, they're not going to grind to a stop because they can't figure out, well, how are we going to express the difference between iPhones, apples, and tennis balls anymore. That is a simple simple phenomenon. So for me, that's the great hope, is if those financial institutions collapse and the states collapse, life will go on.
Yeah.
And really without them. And my big fear is that people say, oh my God, they've collapsed. What are we going to replace it with? Okay, let's get in a dictator, a fascist, or get in the military, or get in somebody, which is what happened to the poor people of Egypt after they heroically threw over their government. They ended up with a choice between the holy book and the weapon and, you know, the military state. They ended up with the holy book, which they didn't like, so they kicked that out and they got the military state. You know, that's what we have to do, is stop accepting that we need this structure, so that when that structure collapses, we don't replace it with another version of itself. That's really...
Yeah, that's such an important...
My solution is grab the solution when it presents itself to us and sits in our arms. Let's grab it and not throw it away and try and put some other crap in there.
Yeah, and when that system falls, I mean, what's going to fall? You know, when you talk about Chase Bank and, you know, all of those guys, when that falls, what falls is the fiat currency. And fiat, you know, fiat lux in Latin means let there be light. So a fiat currency just basically means... let there be currency, except now it's not the people, you know, of the upper echelons or whatever, the banksters and things like that, that are letting the currency be. It's the people that are letting the currency be. But I think that do you feel like people are afraid of that major shift? People are afraid of that major change and really taking responsibility of themselves if the state does fall. It seems like that would be the big fear. And if that did happen, the state would swoop in with, here's the answer. Here, we'll take care of you again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that fear is the great, you know, feedstock of the state.
Yeah.
And they, you know, or I don't know if it's feasible, but that's their biggest tool, mm-hmm. is keeping us frightened of what would happen without them. And that's why we've got a complete insane mess in the Middle East, is fear, you know, starting off with this sort of constructed fear of the Twin Towers. But just ramping it up and up and up, and they live on fear. And again, it's this fear of what would happen. That's why I'm doing this sort of the Apple's tennis balls and iPhones example. This fear of, you know, there is no fear of what happens if these financial institutions collapse, and we won't own them hundreds of billions of dollars into the lifetimes of our children and grandchildren, paying off this debt that got us that kicked 2008 downstream by, you know, creating $1 trillion out of thin air and then saying we the people have to pay that back, because that's what was needed to prop up the banks who created it in the first place. It's such a mad, you know, combination to stop, to because we were frightened of what would happen if they collapsed. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing as bad as what happens if they continue to survive.
Yeah, no kidding, right? You're bringing up owing, you know, money to the banks, owing money to the government. This really, you know, talks about sort of taxes and how much of an intrusion this is into your lives. And I think people forget how much you could do if you had that money back. You have I'm going to read something from your book here. It says, it's just talking about taxes. It says, we take it for granted. It is difficult to conceive the size of the impact that taxation has on the basic running of a business. Tax can often be a single greatest cost passed on to the consumer purchasing products or services. The tax accumulates with import duties, excise taxes, employee taxes, business rates, value-added taxes, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's like we have this intrusion into our lives, and I think people forget that. You know, if you imagine, I mean, I you know, I'm going to work after this interview. I'm going to get paid today. If I had basically a third of my paycheck is being taken by the state, and people are like, I mean, you think it was like, what could I do with that money? What could I do with the community if I had that money back? And I think people forget that a lot because they say, well, what's going to happen if we don't pay this, you know, the state? We're not going to have any roads and stuff. But no. That's not how it works.
And there's so much taken out after that as well.
Exactly.
In other taxes. And if you just think, if all that money is still sloshing around in the system, real money, real wealth that we've created through our labor and our ideas, you know, how much less homelessness, unemployment, hunger, poverty there would be, mm-hmm. if that money hadn't been taken out in the first place. And the social problems that we experience now would be so diminished. And people are charitable. I mean, there's all sorts of charities out there for I don't know about in America, but, you know, to feed starving kids overseas, or abused donkeys, and looking after, there's a people's dispensary for sick animals in the UK is big. So many things are charitably run. People, out of the kindness of their hearts and their empathy, put money into these things. But there are no charities for unemployed workers. There aren't charities for people who need health care. Well, there probably are some, but not many, because that's the government's responsibility. You know, we say, well, that's they're doing that. We'll pick up on what they're not doing. But
so if we take the state out of it, then all of a sudden the people are just going to, in your opinion anyway, my opinion too, that it's naturally going to fill that void.
People are much better than we think. And we have a system now where, unfortunately, psychopaths, sociopaths, paths often rise to the top, and they end up running countries. And the problem with a sociopath, the physical problem in their brain, is that the part of the brain that knows empathy doesn't function. And when you don't have empathy, you don't have sympathy, you don't really have any feeling of what it is like to have your children taken out and, you know, tortured to death in front of you, to pick a grisly example. But there are people who have no empathy for what that's going to feel like. And because those feedback loops are cut in their own brain. And now in the state, those feedback loops are cut by the state. So even if you've got non-sociopaths, you know, where they're working in government departments and bureaus and boards, they're in a sociopathic structure. So whatever their feelings, that's not going to be filtered through to the actual operations of it. And indeed, you do get people running countries who think nothing of initiating a fake war that might result in hundreds of thousands of deaths of innocent men, women, and children, because they don't care, because their buddies in the arms industry and the military are going to do really well out of it. And it's appalling for somebody with connected feedback loops to believe that there are people on the planet who could be that way, but they are. And, you know, some of them are locked up in mental institutions, and some of them are running the major parts of the country.
You know, it's really interesting, because obviously you've dealt in a lot of philosophy, and philosopher yourself. I think when you get into philosophy, you really see that evil is an inherent part of being part of this creation, that there's good and evil, if you will, chaos and order, if you will. And then I think a lot of people have a really hard time facing that fact, because it really makes you kind of look into yourself and sort of question these things. And yet this is a very prevalent part of the state. It almost as if the state gives evil people an avenue to reach the top, if you will.
Yeah, and it absolutely does. If you are a gangster, organized crime, you are forcibly taking money from people that they wouldn't otherwise give you, and running your operation with this. And, you know, the ultimate goal is to run a country. You know, that's the ultimate goal. And, you know, Joe Kennedy was a bootlegger, part of the organized crime of his day. And he got his sons into power. This was, and then they went bad, because they decided they were going to be presidents and try and do a JFK and try and do some good. But that wasn't the objective when Joe put him up, you know, to be the president. Putin in Russia is a gangster, out and out. I'm not. You know, in that case, you know, at least he's his own gangster, and he's not being run by the banks and the military industrial complex. So
he doesn't even seem to shy away from that fact either.
No, and but he's his own gangster, which is a little bit preferable to a gangster who or an imbecile who's run by other gangsters. At least he can think for himself. Yeah. But that's where they want to go. And occasionally you'll get somebody like Gandhi, or maybe Jimmy Carter, gets to the top and tries to do some good, and maybe does some good. But they eventually die. They're often assassinated. And whoever comes to replace them doesn't keep up their work, because that's not how they grease their palms.
We have about 10 minutes left here, and I want to hit on something here. Since you're a pioneer in the organic food industry, I want to talk about GMOs a little bit here. And talking about the government and their relationship to, you know, the major manufacturers here. You have a quote here. I want to read this. This comes from, see if I can find this here. This comes from Phil Engel, I guess, and he is
right.
Yeah, this is just. Listen to this, people. So this is Phil Engel. This is Monsanto's director of corporate communications. And he said this was in the New York Times in 1998. It says, Monsanto should not have to vouchsafe the safety of biotech food. Our interest is in selling as much of it as possible. Assuring its safety is the FDA's job. So, you know, when I read this, I was thinking about something. It was like, okay, in the United States here in California, we had the proposition, I think it was Proposition 37, I want to say it was, 37, basically to say label GMO foods. There was this big movement, there was pamphlets and flyers and banners, and people got together. And to me, it was almost absurd, because it was like, okay, well, wait a second. Why are we petitioning the government, propositioning the government to label food? Isn't that the FDA's job? And the point is like, okay, well, if that's the FDA's job and they're not doing their job, well, then shouldn't we fire the FDA? I mean, if I don't go to work today, I might not get fired. If I don't go to work tomorrow, I might not get fired. If I show up on Wednesday and don't do anything, chances are I'm going to get fired because I'm not doing my job.
Yeah.
The FDA doesn't do its job, and we're just like, well, you know, we'll petition you to try to get you to do this job. Well,
that's because there's no feedback loop. You know, with no feedback loop, people don't get fired. That sort of stuff doesn't happen. And again, let's just come back to freedom. In a free market, GMOs would not be there, because no business operates without insurance. And it's not because it's legally required. It is in some areas, but because you're nuts. If you're running a business and you haven't got insurance, you are up against ultimate risk. And if heaven forbid, like I created the first ever veggie burger, if heaven forbid somebody had died on a veggie burger, I could have lost my house if I didn't have insurance. Mm-hmm. So I get insurance, and of course insurers don't cover anybody willy-nilly. They want to make sure you're not going to be killing people with your product before they do it. Mm-hmm. So they put down rules of engagement. And rules of engagement for nuclear power plants, there would be none. No insurance company in the world would cover a nuclear power plant. No insurance company would cover GMO foods, mm-hmm, or anybody selling them, because it's untried, you know, it's untested. Who knows what the dangers are from a continued diet of GMO foods. But when the government comes in and says, yes, these are okay, they're just the same as other foods, then they can sell it, labeled or unlabeled. That's a kind of further down the road. You know, if insurance companies said, yes, you can sell GMO foods, then we would decide whether they're labeled or not. I mean, in Germany now, the supermarkets have instructed their suppliers of meat that the meat is not to be fed GMO food. It's not the people, it's the supermarkets, because they know what the people want, and they're part of that joined up feedback loop where you have, you know, freedom running to a degree. Yeah, it's not a question. We're never going to get the FDA. We're never going to get the state to do its job. Mm-hmm. And there's no point just throwing our hands up in the air and saying, oh, well, they should, shouldn't they? Because they're not. And that's really what we have to get into our heads and start doing it ourselves. And the more we do things to replace the state, go out and only buy products that say no GMO ingredients on them, if we start doing that, then the people with GMO ingredients will start taking them out. That's how it works.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me the way to sort of fight back is to say, well, I don't want to pay for this stuff anymore. If the FDA is not doing its job, well, then I'm not going to pay my taxes to pay for this institution to not do its job, you know? So it seems like that would be the, you know, civil disobedient way of taking care of a problem. I mean, let me get your take on this, too. It's like when you know, we talk about like not paying taxes or whatever. It's like, if I don't pay my taxes this year, I'm going to have, you know, the IRS beat down my door and seize my house and all of that sort of thing. But it seems that there's almost like a strength in numbers thing that we have to do. That if we're tired of paying these exorbitant taxes, these absolute intrusion into our lives, well then it just can't be a singular person that does it. It has to be en masse that people get together and say, hey, on this date we are no longer paying for the FDA. On this date we're no longer paying these taxes because, you know. And so this to me seems like more of a resolution or a solution to these problems to really take down these bloated organizations.
It could be if there were a massive tax strike,
yeah,
of some. But you'd have to have the corporations who take the tax out of your pay before you see it would have to be involved in that. And obviously, I would like to see that happen tomorrow. But in practice, it's only going to happen when things get so bad that everybody is willing to do that. And that could be quite a rotten situation. But then again, there might be this quantum leap where suddenly the penny drops and people see the light on that. But I don't know. I haven't got a lot of hope for it, but it would be good if they did.
Yeah, it just seems like there's, you know, we really have to, I mean, it's really unfortunate that things have to get so bad before, I mean, maybe that's just how it works too. Maybe things have to get so bad before these natural solutions spring up that, you know, come from the wellspring of the people itself. And as you point out in the book, it seems like those are some of the things, like you talk about nonviolent action, you know, the Occupy movement, things like that, that are sort of springing up to try to take care of these problems in an organic and natural way.
Yeah, I mean, we are responding, and we're responding more than we ever have before. So that I'm optimistic about. Because a lot of people realize what's going on and would like to change it. My book is just, my book. I don't know if you mentioned my book in the title of it. It's called "The State Is Out of Date. We Can Do It Better."
Yeah.
I've got websites. Do you put all that up on your posting when it goes up?
Yeah. I do a whole intro before this, and then we'll actually talk about this. Well, actually, we're kind of finishing up the interview right now. So if there's anything you want to give out your info.
Well,
we were
going to talk about both books, but we didn't get the Son of God.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I would love to talk about that book too as well. So.
Okay. But my website is gregorysams.com. Mm-hmm. And if you just Google Gregory Sams, you'll get the website. The book's on sale at Amazon and everything else. It's all there. And I have hope for humanity because I've seen so much change in people's attitudes happening in the last 40 years. I've also seen the state getting stronger and stronger, and NSA, reading all of our stuff. I mean, some of the stuff is appalling, but we are finding out about it, and we have got the internet, and the internet does connect us in a way that we've never been connected before. I mean, we look at how laying a telegraph cable across the Atlantic to go dit dit da da dit changed the world. Mm-hmm. Now we are connected a million times more than the telegraph, and we are seeing change come out of that, whether it's on the commercial levels like Airbnb and Uber and PayPal and eBay. I mean, it's in Skype and YouTube. I mean, it's just fantastic what we are doing with that, and I think we'll continue to do more even if the NSA is snooping on us. I don't know if they can snoop enough to actually counter the level of tidal wave that could be approaching them.
Yeah, I really like the fact that the subtitle of your book, "The State Is Out of Date," is called "We Can Do It Better," because that is almost like a proclamation to any sort of critics. It's saying, no, we can do better than the state. We can do this better. We can do this organically. We can do this with the creativity of that's inherent within the human being.
Yeah. And have a lot of money left over after we've done it better as well.
Yeah, we can thrive as opposed to just barely surviving.
I know, and it's just so important to get that message across. And as and when the state collapses, sure, it could be a year or two of real difficulty getting things going properly again. But once we do, then they continue going, and they don't drag us down in order to continue going. Because there's no reason why we can't live in peace and harmony amongst each other. We're designed to do that and fully capable.
Yeah. Well said, man. Well said. Unfortunately, we didn't get to a lot of things that I wanted to talk about. This isn't only an hour show. So, but yeah, please check out the book, The State is Out of Date. We Can Do It Better. And then your other book is called The Son of God. GregorySams.com, as he was saying. Fantastic book, man. Like I said, I finished it last night. I really enjoyed it. And I know you're a busy guy, but if you get a chance, maybe we could do this again in the future.
Well, maybe we can do one on the S-U-N of God book without a cap. Okay.
I would love to do it. So.
All right.
All right, man. Okay, well, yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day. Yep.
You too. All right. Yep, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Our outro song is called Love Will Find a Way from the record Gimme the Jimmies and is provided by the Southern Wisconsin blues outfit, The Jimmies. I've known these guys for years and they're just genuinely cool human beings and they play all over the Midwest and they put on a great show. They have a full horn section, great rhythm section, and Jimmy is just a dynamic keyboard player and singer-songwriter, and this is just a tremendous song. Their website is www.thejimmies.net and you can purchase their record on iTunes as well as on their site. Coming up in the next few episodes of the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour include interviews with Ian Mangiardi and Andy Laub from As It Happens TV. These guys hiked the Pacific Crest Trail and produced a documentary about the journey. We will also be speaking with the poet Holly McNish as well as the author of Astro Music, Ezra Sanzer's Bell. Be sure to stay tuned and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
My side, and everything I feel will be cast. You've been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathemagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com. And be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.